Thanks, Kevin. I'm Lee, alcoholic. And I appreciate the group bringing me up. I would like to thank you for that. Also, Bob, for inviting me. My home group is the Tuesday night men's stag in Rio Grande, California. My sobriety date is December 10th, 1987, and my sponsor is a man named Bob Darrell. Now, usually when I go somewhere and talk, I got to explain that he's in Vegas, but you guys know right where he is. And the reason that I share those things is threefold. One, that's what I've been taught to do, like Susie. I've been taught to share those things, so I do. Two, I am very proud of all three of those things. My men's stag group is the best stag in the world. My sobriety date, December 10th, 1987, it's a great date. And if you're in here tonight and you're an alcoholic, you have a sobriety date. And keep it. It's a great date. If you're an Al-Anon, you got whatever date you guys have. But it's a good day. And my sponsor, Bob, you know, I'm the best sponsor in the world. Absolutely, for me, the best sponsor in the world. He has helped me. He finishes my sentences for me sometimes, knowing exactly what I'm going to say. And it might be some off-the-wall crazy thing, and he's been there, done that. So the best sponsor in the world for me. And then the third reason I share those things is I go to a lot of speaker meetings. And I know what it's like to sit in the audience and wonder how much time the speaker got. You know, well, now you know, December 10th, 1987. Those of you with less time than me, you know, pay attention. Those of you with more time than me will evaluate everything I say. And those of you with about the same amount of time as me are going to criticize and condemn everything I say. I know. I would have said that if I was up there. Well, they got me up here tonight, you know. That's the deal. On December 10th, 1987, I woke up. I went to the front room, and I pulled down a fifth of whiskey I had opened the night before. And there was about a finger's width left in the bottom of it. And I looked at my wife, and I said, "How much of this did you drink?" And she said, "None of it." And I said, "Damn it. I did it again. I had not intended to drink a fifth of whiskey. It was the last day of finals. I was going to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo College. Took my last final of the day. Came home. Was going to get a little buzz on. Not drink a fifth. So I made a few phone calls and found out about where these AA meetings are. And so at noon that day, I was at a big book study of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not tell you what part of the book was read, who was there other than one person, what was said, nothing. The one person I could tell you about, though, was a man named Jack Lanigan. And Jack, the reason I remember Jack is because after the meeting, Jack came up to me and he put out his hand and he said, "Welcome." And he started talking to me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a big book. Third edition big book, just like this one. And he tried to give it to me. And I wouldn't take it. I said, no. And the reason I wouldn't take it, anybody else been to college? I was paying 50, 60 bucks for books like this. And I figured that's what AA was going to charge me, 50, 60 bucks. And at college, at school, you can sell the book back at the end of the quarter. And I knew AA wasn't going to buy it back. So I wouldn't take it. But somewhere along the line, Jack told me the cost and told me the deal, and I did accept that book from him. And I flew out here today. But if when I go places, I have a trunk full of big books of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I give them away for fun and for free, just like I was taught, you know. And I can't offer any of the newcomers one tonight because I don't have one with me. I flew, but somebody else will give you one. And then somewhere in the meeting, or Jack must have said something about sponsorship, because I asked him, "Well, what's a sponsor?" And he told me what a sponsor is. And I said, "Well, will you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Sure." So at the end of my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a big book and a sponsor. How many of you can say that? Sometimes a hand goes up. Yeah. See, unfortunately, I didn't call that sponsor or read that book for 5.5 years. Now how many people, you know? Yeah, 5.5 years I was stark raving sober. Stark raving sober. I came here to not drink, and I was not drinking just fine. Thank you very much. You know, I didn't come here to pour coffee or set up chairs. I came here to not drink. I'd share things like, "If you don't drink and you don't use, no matter how you do it, you're not wrong." And then they wouldn't call on me again. And I'd get a resentment, and I would punish that meeting, and I'd quit going to it. If they're not calling on me, I'm not going. And within a relatively short period of time, I wasn't going to many meetings because I was punishing them all. If they're not calling on me, I'm not going. And then at 5.5 years of that, my wife came across some poetry I'd written. Really dark, dark poetry. And it said stuff like, you know, I don't remember. I still have it. I don't read it anymore. But it says something like, you know, who knows one day what you'll find. I'll get a gun and blow my mind. Stuff like that. So my wife was concerned. And and the next day, I got checked into the psych ward at French Hospital in San Luis Obispo. See, on December 10th, 1987, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. Absolutely, no doubt about it. I can't drink. But my life unmanageable? Hell no. You know, My life, I can manage my life just fine, I thought. But in the psych ward, it really hit me that people that manage their lives well, that's not where they end up. They don't go to the psych ward. People that, you know, they just don't. So I got involved. I started working the steps. I did an inventory in there, which I'm not going to go into due to time tonight, but I did the work. I started the work. I went to meetings. In the psych ward, they let me out. They usually don't, but in my case, they let me out. The hospital was across the train tracks from the Alano Club in San Luis Obispo, where I got sober, the Pioneer Group. And I used to just, they'd go to the 7 a.m. meetings, the noon meetings, the 5:30 meetings, and the 8 o'clock meetings, you know. I paid $16,000, my insurance company paid $16,000 for me to cross the train tracks and go to an AA meeting, you know, and finally do an inventory. But, and I got out of there, and I got involved in service. I took over Sunday night discussion meeting. Someone else nominated me, and I took over the home group I have now, the Tuesday Night Men's Stag. Way back then, I was the secretary of that meeting. Someone else nominated me to be the Grapevine rep for the district, and I got involved in service, and I became a whole new man, completely different person. Happy, joyous, and free. You know, I work the steps now. I'm getting involved in the fellowship and being involved in sort of pouring, happy to pour your coffee. Happy. Whoever got here early to set these chairs up, thank you, you know, because it's not always easy. Like Charlie C. says, you know, the people who are comfortable in sobriety are those of us who are willing to be a little bit inconvenienced by Alcoholics Anonymous. And whoever came here early and put these chairs up and put the salt in the coffee, I don't know about that one, but, you know, that's not always fun. And those of us that stay afterwards and put away these chairs, it's not always fun, you know, especially when the church, I spoke here a couple years ago and you were at that nice church where you didn't have to set up anything. It's a lot easier there, isn't it? But, you know, here's a chance to be of service. I suggest you get one more service commitment. Who's in charge of service commitments? Somebody? Nobody? Secretary? Kim? Get a service commitment to save the speaker a chair. I had to fight for my chair tonight. Just kidding. Barry took care of me. Barry took care of me. But we had to struggle it around. But, so I became a whole new person, you know, and, you know, but I always go back to, but who was I? You know, I don't remember my first drink. I absolutely do not remember it. I envy like people like Susie that, you know, tequila, her first drink. Woo, baby, that's good there. But, you know, I don't remember my first drink. I've prayed about it. I've asked God. I just don't have any idea. I guess concepts. I have ideas, but no real remembrance of it. What I do know, I'm a child of the 60s. My mom was I grew up in San Diego. My mom was a very, very active anti-Vietnam War protester, love-ins, all those left-wing things that leftist left-wing people do. Not that I'm criticizing, but I just, you know, that's what they do. My mom is so far left, she's a danger to oncoming traffic. I mean, she's very out there. And I joined the military at 18. And yeah, already you get the idea, right? But I went home on leave that first year, and Thanksgiving, I went home, and we went to Thanksgiving dinner, where we always went every year, and the same friends of my mom, and they were teasing me, you know, joking about my uniform and, you know, all this stuff, and they just weren't getting to me. It wasn't bothering me, because I'd been through basic training and all this propaganda, and I was very, you know, I was happy and proud of who I was. And then they said something that did get to me, and what they said was, you know, Lee, you look sharp in that uniform today. But, you know, you didn't look so sharp that time you were 5 years old and we gave you that hit of acid. You were tripping that day, man. I was like, what? You guys gave me acid when I was 5 years old? I was like, damn, man. I was resentful about that for years. Angry at my mom. Angry at the world for giving, you know. Now it's just part of my story. I was eating acid at 5. Okay. I remember stealing beer out of the back of the thrifty drugstore in 6th grade. It's 11, 12 years old. Yeah, Slitz Malt Liquor. Remember Slitz Malt Liquor? Yeah. I was sharing about that one time. I was like, you know, I don't even know if they make Slitz Malt Liquor anymore. Newcomer was nodding his head. Yeah. Slits malt liquor and Southern Comfort. Yeah, there you go. Usually when you, although Susie's already shared about, usually when you say Southern Comfort in AA meeting, people start drooling and, oh, remember, you know, Southern Comfort and Slits malt liquor, 11, 12 years old, you know. When I matured at about the age of 14, I found whiskey and it became whiskey. You know, I drank whiskey straight up, you know, that's what I drank, you know. And you know, the reason I drank whiskey, other than the fact I'm an alcoholic, all seriousness, that's what John Wayne drank, man. That's what Clint Eastwood drank, you know. Real men drink whiskey. The Outlaw Josie Wales drinks whiskey straight up, you know. Halfway through that movie, Outlaw Josie Wales, it's one of the best guy movies ever made, man. And halfway through that movie, two-thirds of the way through that movie, Josie Wales walks into this old ghost town, and walks into the bar, and they say, what'll it be, partner? And he says, whiskey, straight up. And they say, partner, we've been dry up, and we've been dry in this town for years. So what does Josie Wales do? He walks out. He leaves the bar, right? You hear his spurs jingling. And then he hears the spurs jingling back towards the doorway. He kicks open those saloon doors. He's got a case of whiskey in one hand, a bottle of whiskey in the other hand, and he's the man. They love him, you know. He gets the girl. He kills all the bad guys. He rides off into the sunset, and he wins. And that's what I wanted to be, just like Josie Wales. But that's not what happens in the real world. In the real world, it's a suspended sentence for assault and battery. That's what the real world is, you know. Josie Wales, that's what it was like. But and John Wayne, you know, if John Wayne would have walked into the bar, walked up to the bartender and said, you know, pass the crack pipe, partner, you'd have a different speaker because I'd be over in N.A. because I'd have been smoking crack. But that's not what John Wayne asked for. John Wayne asked for whiskey straight up, you know, and those were my role models, man. I love those guys. Paul Simon wrote a song that reminds me of my childhood completely. Paul Simon and Garfunkel sing it. It's called I'm a Rock, I'm an Island. And in that song, this is my childhood. They start out, it says, I build walls, a fortress deep and mighty that none may penetrate. I have no need of friendship. Friendship causes pain. It's laughter and it's loving I disdain. And I could just, that's totally how I felt. Friends hurt you. They always hurt you. It's always going to be that way. And I'm not going to let anybody get close to me ever. Because if you get close to me, you're going to hurt me, and that ain't going to happen. And that's how I was growing up. When I got drunk, then the walls would come down. Then I'd be happy again, you know. Push. Matchbox 20 has a song called Push, and it's similar type deal. And it says, you know, I don't know if I've ever been good enough. I'm a little bit angry, and I feel like my head is caving in. I don't know if I've ever been good enough. And that's how I felt growing up. I never felt good enough growing up, unless I'm hanging with Jack Daniels. Me and Jack Daniels are hanging, and I'm fine. And it's not going to be my head caving in. It's going to be his. Somebody else's. Because I'd go one of two directions when I got drunk. I would get very, very, very romantic. I was a gentleman, really. Or I would get very, very, very violent. Now, the deal is, to get romantic, you got to have a willing partner. You know, you can't just get romantic with any girl on the dance floor, or, you know, they kind of push you away if they're not in the mood, you know, or they don't want it, you know, but, to get violent, it isn't that way. I don't know if I mentioned, I grew up on the beach, Mission Beach in San Diego, and, in Mission Beach, there's a boardwalk, and we'd just get up on the boardwalk drinking, and if someone walked by, we'd hit him, you know, and it'd be on. And if I didn't feel like hitting him, Mike would hit him, or one of my other friends, the other Mike, which reminds me, I forgot to say, it's good to see Mike. I first met Mike, he was the chairperson at the Spring Roundup in San Diego, and he was there, and Alan, I forgot about Alan. I got up here nervous after I said my sobriety date, I was worried the damn microphone was going to get cut off, so thanks for not cutting me off. And Kevin, the last time I spoke here, he was the 10-minute speaker, so... And all my other brothers in sobriety out there. But now I forgot where I was going, which I shouldn't have said. Mission Beach hitting guys, thank you. Yeah, so one of my friends would hit somebody and it would be on. And then, you know, that's how it would go. Very, very, very violent. When I went back the next time on leave in that military, one of my friends was dead, murdered, dead. He stole some guy's Harley and the guys didn't appreciate it much, so they killed him. And the other guy was in the hospital for shooting up cocaine. He OD'd mainlining cocaine. And that would have been me, but I joined the military. I joined the military at 18, as I mentioned. And I went into a thing called Special Forces, also known as the Green Beret. Why would that be? John Wayne was a Green Beret. That's right. If John Wayne would have been a Navy SEAL, I'd have joined the Navy. If it would have been Air Force Pararescue, I'd have joined the Air Force. But John Wayne was a Green Beret, so I joined the Green Berets, man. And I know I've been corrected. There's guys out here that are older than me, and right now you're thinking to yourself, and I've been told after a meeting, John Wayne was a Marine before he was a Green Beret. I didn't see that movie. I saw the Green Berets, you know. I got it. I know. But I saw the Green Berets, and that's what I joined, you know. And in the military, back then the slogan was, it's a great place to start. And for me, it was. I matured a little bit in the military. I got money to go to college in the military. And the other thing, though, is I got turned on to country music, man. You know, I mean, country music? Are you kidding me? You know, I grew up on the beach, like I said. And, you know, who the hell listens to country music? Don't raise your hand. I was speaking in Bakersfield. Everybody in the group raised their hand. Yeah, see, somebody already beat me to it. Yeah. You know, country music, man, I thought country music was for hicks, man. But I tell you what, if you can't make it to the meeting on time here in Vegas, because I know there's traffic here now, I've seen it when I've been up here before. If you can't make it to the meeting on time, put it on the country music station, because they got it all. Yeah, everybody knows about country music. They're famous for drinking. Sure, Willie Nelson has a good song talking about, you know, last night I went to bed at 2 with a 10, woke up at 10 with a 2. You know, you can change the gender on that one if you need to. But, you know, or there's other ones, you know, I got home at, I got home, but she changed all the locks because I got home at the wrong 5 o'clock. So, you know, they got all that drinking in there. And one of my favorites is, tequila makes her clothes fall off. that's a good one. I like that one. But, and if you're an addict, you're not left out. Don't worry. Hank Williams has a song. He said, you know, Hank, for the addicts in the audience, I know there's one over here, a newcomer. Hank Williams says, she told me she loved me, and I told her that I'd do the same, but I OD'd in Denver, and I just can't remember her name. So they got it. Yeah, they got it. And they get sober. They get sober in country music, too. Toby Keith got a song. He says, I sobered up, and I got to thinking. You ain't as much fun since I quit drinking. Don't sing that one around the Al-Anons, man. The Al-Anons are not too hot on that one. And the newcomer song, newcomer, you know, the country music newcomer song? I want to talk about number one, oh my, for the newcomers, yeah. And then the other thing, though, not just country music in general, but the other thing I got turned on to, and, you know, in a room this size, some of you guys are going to have heard of this guy, but I got turned on to a guy named Dave Allen Coe. Anybody? A few. All right, there's a few. All right, now if you go look it up on the internet, I am not talking about his racist, sexist songs. He's got a whole slew of those, and I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about some of his more mainline songs, and the reason is, and I did this in an inventory once, I figured out why I like David Allen Coe so much, and the reason I liked him so much is because what he sings about, pain, heartache, and betrayal. You trust a woman, she's going to hurt you, therefore don't trust them. You know, one of his songs is I Hate Love. More than anything else in life, I hate love. Or love is a never-ending war. March me into action. I'm well-trained for what's in store. Or one of my all-time favorites before I worked the steps, before I got sober, was Now I Lay Me Down to Cheat, you know, on the woman that I love so. You know, and that's what David sang about, you know, all that kind of pain, heartache, and betrayal. Because if you go back to the, and I'm kind of getting on songs tonight, but back to that Push song, That push about, you know, the Matchbox 20 song, the second line to that first verse, they say, I don't know if I've ever been really loved by a hand that's touched me. And that's how I felt growing up, you know. I don't remember my mom. Granted, I've done the inventory, and I love my mom. My mom did the best she could with the tools she had. I got it. You people taught me that. My sponsor taught me that. I got it. My mom did the best she could with the tools she had. I got it. Now put that over here on a shelf, all right? It still sucked, you know. I mean, growing up sucked. You know, I was raised on welfare in San Diego, and, you know, I remember commodities way back before food stamps. They had commodities and blah, 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 blah. So, but I don't, my mom did a lot of good things, but I don't ever remember her telling me I love you, never once, you know. And what I would do in my relationships were 30 and out, 30 and out, 30 and out, 30 and out. That's one of the things Bob finishes my sentence for me one time. A few years ago, I was talking to Bob about relationships and things, and I was talking about back in the old days and some things that happened, but back in the old days, I used to find ways to make the girl break up with me, all right? And I thought he was going to look at me like I was an alien. Like, what are you talking about? You know, I'd have to explain it to him. I don't know, I would say funny things, and I would try to get the girl to break up with me. And you know what he said? He said, it's an art form, isn't it? He knew exactly what I was talking about. And those of you in the audience who are shaking your heads, you knew what I was talking about. And it blows me away. All these years, I thought I was alone. I thought no one knew what it would be like to. I used to try to get them to break up with me at 30 days. And the reason at 30 days is why? Because at 30 days, she's getting close to me. And if she gets close to me, she's going to hurt me. And I will sabotage the relationship before I let her get close to me. It ain't going to happen, you know. 30 and out, 30 and out, 30 and out. Into the military. And that's until my now almost, well, it's 82, so 24 and a half years of marriage. My wife and I have been married now 24 and a half years. It was a little time off for bad behavior, yeah. But, you know, and that's thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Al-Anon. And I'm gonna jump forward. I gotta talk about family. I always talk about family. But before I do that, you know, a little bit about the steps. I'm gonna jump, you know, as I mentioned, for 5.5 years I worked half a step. And then when I was in that psych ward, I realized my life was unmanageable also. And I worked the other half of the first step. But the second step talked about God, higher power. No thanks. Not interested. My mom taught me that people are stupid and weak who believe in God. Therefore, I'm not even going to touch God. If you want a God, fine. You can have God. But the other part of the steps also talked about restored to sanity. Well, I'm not insane. I'm not asking Jack or anybody else at that time, can you help me understand these steps? I'm just figuring, okay, to be restored to sanity, you must be insane. And my idea of insanity was any early Jack Nicholson movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or The Shining. Either one of those would work. And I'm nowhere near like either of those movies, therefore I'm not insane. I don't need to be restored to sanity. Thank you very much. Then someone said something at a meeting, and when I started listening at meetings, and it made a lot of difference, made all the difference to me. And I'm a big Charger fan. I love the San Diego Chargers. I've always loved the San Diego Chargers my whole life. Not just on the bandwagon now. When the Chargers were 1-15, I was a Charger fan. I was an angry Charger fan, but I was a Charger fan, you know. I lost it again. I'm sorry. Second step, that's right, and the third. So, that's what it was. A woman said to get a case of Coca-Cola on Sunday morning while you're watching the football game and drink it. Drink that case of Coca-Cola while you're watching the football game. Are you kidding me? That's gross. That's sick. Can you imagine drinking a case of Coke while you're watching a football game? Now make it Coors or Budweiser or Corona for the newer people. Yeah, that's doable. I can do that. Well, that's insane thinking. That's insane thinking because it's exactly the same amount of liquid. And I was like, oh, okay, I got it. Yeah, that's insane thinking. And someone else said, when we do things that are good for us and we do them over and over again, that's called intelligence. When we do things that are bad for us and we do them over and over again, thinking that this time it's going to be different, that's insanity. And that's what I've been doing those first 5.5 years. Same thing over and over again. But then you get to that third step. And now we're big time into God. And turn your will and your life over the care of God? I'm not interested. I don't want to hear about God. And what happened to me, my first spiritual experience came in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I used to share that the only reason I didn't get drunk those first 5.5 years is I got lucky. I don't know why did I stay sober, stay away from drinking and other people. And after the meeting, a young guy, newcomer, his nickname was Catholic Brian because he was a very religious man. Brian came up to me after a meeting once, and he said, you know what, Lee, you didn't get lucky. He said, you had a God in your life looking out for you, and you didn't even believe in him. And I was like, wow. And it hit. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, all right. If he'd have said that a week later or a day sooner, would it have hit? I don't know. He said it when he said it, and I found a God of my understanding at that meeting. And move forward, you know. And then someone else suggested getting on your knees and praying. I don't know, man. You name one movie John Wayne got on his knees. You know, Clint Eastwood was a preacher in Pale Rider. He didn't get on his knees one time. Real men don't get on their knees. But someone suggested it and, you know, gave me a couple ideas, and I tried one of them. One of them, and I'll say it, even though half the room has probably heard it, but the other half hasn't, the newcomers that are here. Someone said, you know, what you do is put your shoes underneath your bed at night. Put your shoes underneath your bed, and while you're down there on your knees, putting your shoes away, say a quick prayer. I thought, well, I can do that. I drew the shades, locked the door, and I put my shoes underneath my bed. And it worked. It was more of a spiritual experience for me. I found another, more of a higher power, more stuff. Now, maybe you got a mattress that's on the floor, or you don't have shoes to put on your bed. I got a couple other suggestions you might try. One of them, you know, most people, when you get on your knees and pray, you think, you know, you put your hands in front of you like this, and that's how I do it. You know, you don't have to put your hands in front of you like that. You can put your hands out in front of you like this. get on your knees, and pretend there's a toilet in front of you. Rah! You know, and you're puking, right? I could get on my knees monthly, at least on a monthly basis, I could get on my knees and puke for a toilet. I couldn't get on my knees for God. I did, and it made a difference. All right, you weren't a puker. You didn't puke. All right, I got another one, a visual for you. How about this one? You put your hands behind your back. Yeah, somebody relating to that one, yeah. Yeah, the cops arrested me first, and they're busting my friends afterwards. They stick you in a corner on your knees with your hands cuffed behind your back. I could get on my knees for the cops, but I couldn't get on my knees for God. You know, give it a shot. You ain't got nothing to lose. You know, lock the door, draw the shades. No one needs to see you. It's all right. You know, give it a shot. It used to say, humbly on our knees, ask God. And then they said, hey, wait a minute, time out. What do you got on other knees for? And they took that out of that step, you know. Joan Osborne has a song, and it's the best analogy to the third step I've ever heard. It's called One of Us. And in that song, she says, if God had a face, what would it look like? And would you want to see if seeing meant you'd have to believe? That's the third step right there. If God had a face, and you could look at it, but if you looked, you'd have to believe. Would you look? And if you just said to yourself, well, hell yeah, I'd look. Well, then you're willing. You're willing to believe. And that's all you got to do is just be willing, just a little bit. And you crack the door. And boom, you're amazed what happens, you know. And the fourth step, and that's the last step I'm going to talk about tonight, is, you know, the inventory. I put it off. I did it in the psych ward while I was in there. And what I've discovered in my now 19 years of sobriety, what I believe, I believe there's no wrong way to do a fourth step. I believe you get better as you go along. You know, as you do a second four step and a third four step and a fourth and on to do a 20th, you've had to have done a 19th. To continue to do it, you got to start, right? And you get better. You get with your sponsor and he or she will help you out and you move forward. You know, you get better at doing the inventories. But my first inventory, the one I did in the psych ward, it's a joke. It's so bad. It's terrible. It's a grudge list. It's exactly what it says on page 65, I think it is in the book. It's a grudge list. It's what you did to me. There's no part in it that about what I did. However, that inventory is very effective with the guys that I work with that are hesitant and slow and procrastinating on doing an inventory, because what I do, eventually I'll pull it out and I'll show it to them. You want to wait, you know, because it's written on San Luis Obispo French Hospital Psychiatric Ward letterhead, you know. You want to wait, you can wait, man. In NA, they say jails, institutions, and deaths. And for me, it was an institution that it took for me to get there, you know. I got to talk a little bit about family, because I love my family. It's unusual I don't go anywhere with one of my kids or my wife with me, but flying up here and all that stuff tonight, it was a little bit different. And because my family is very active with me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my wife's a member of Al-Anon. My daughter Jessica, who turned 18 yesterday, as a matter of fact, she's had more commitments at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous than many alcoholics have. You know, she's a very, very committed member, or non-member, actually, of Alcoholics Anonymous. It kind of reminds me of another story about my son. It reminds me of these two convicts that were on death row in a penitentiary, and they were on death row. And through H&I, which I know you guys are real involved in, I see on the meeting schedule you guys do detox, and I don't think there's any federal joints out here, but there's probably some state joints and whatever. That's how I met Bob. I used to work at the penitentiary in Lompoc, California. Convict in the back going, damn, I thought he looked familiar. Yeah, you know, I used to work at the penitentiary in Lompoc, and through a series of events, I'm an accountant by trade, and I'm not going to go into it, but anyways, the warden moved me into the psych department as a drug treatment specialist. He called me to his office one day and he said, you know what, you're a fine accountant. I got no problem with your work, but you're more valuable than me working with these guys one-on-one. How'd you like to be a drug treatment specialist? And I said, sir, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad you noticed. But you know what, sir, I do it for fun and for free to stay sober myself. And thanks, but no thanks. He said, you don't understand. I'm the warden. Tomorrow you report to psych services and you got a new job. And anyways, I used to bring in these speakers to talk to the convicts on a monthly basis, the first Saturday of each month. And they used to have a joke, commit a crime, go to prison, have circuit speakers come visit you. It was good, yeah. But that's where I first met Bob. But these two convicts were on death row, and through H&I they got sober and they became model prisoners. And the warden noticed it, and he went to the first convict and he said, you know, I've noticed you've turned your life around. What can I do to help you? What can I do to improve your life before your time comes and we must execute you? And the first convict said, sir, if I can carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere on the compound, I'd really appreciate it. Warden said, let's see what I can do. He went to the second convict and he asked him the same thing. What can I do before your time comes? The second convict said, execute me, warden, immediately. If I got to hear his story one more time. And that's what it's like for my kids sometimes. You know, I was speaking in Goleta once. which is about an hour from my house, and I was going to take a sponsee with me. And he called at the last minute and canceled, said he couldn't go. So I went up to my son's room, Jeremiah, and I said, "Hey, Jeremiah, I'm speaking tonight in Goleta. You want to come?" He was playing in PlayStation. He didn't even look up. He said, "Convicts, Dad, death row. I'm the second one." So, because my kids had come, you know, they travel with me. And one time I was talking in Thousand Oaks, which is about 2 hours from my house. I took my daughter Emily with me. I have a 24-year-old, 19-year-old, 18-year-old, and a 16-year-old. And I took Emily with me. And we got to Thousand Oaks, and I couldn't find the church I was supposed to talk at. And I thought about it for a minute, and I'm like, you know what, ain't no big deal. They'll just get someone out of the audience. They don't need me there to talk. And I got 2 hours with my daughter here, and I'm going to get 2 hours with my daughter back. You know, and sure enough, I ended up finding the church. But the point is, I got to spend time with my child down there and back. And Jessica, as I mentioned, has had commitments. That speaker meeting I told you about, where I'd bring them into prison, and then that night they'd speak out on the street on the first Saturday of each month. And Jessica had a commitment at that meeting. She was a bell ringer to let people know it was time to come in from the break. And she sold the tapes, and she counted the seven traditions. She was about 11 years old, 10 years old. First Saturday of the month only. 1 month she got invited to go to a birthday party overnight or slumber party with all her other little girlfriends. And she asked her mom, "What should I do?" And my wife, Jacqueline, said, go ahead and go to the birthday party. And Jessica came up to me and said, "Dad, you know, here's what's going on. It's a birthday party, the meeting. What should I do?" And I said, "Hun, hey, it's okay, baby. You go to the birthday party. It's fine. It's fine, really." And she looked up at me and she said, "But, Dad, I have a commitment, you know." So I asked her to sponsor me. I was like, damn, you know, I got guys that I sponsored that didn't show up at that meeting for girls or whatever. And here's my daughter. And sure enough, she came to the meeting, rang the bell, and we took her to the birthday party afterwards, you know. And she made it fine. Didn't skip a beat, you know. My son Jeremiah, one time, he's fighting over taking Robitussin. He had a cough. Me and my wife were trying to get any parents out here, you know, your kid's got a cough and you want to get him to take their medicine. He wouldn't take it. And Robitussin comes nowadays with a little plastic shot glass on the top of it, right? So we poured that little shot of Robitussin for him, and he finally agreed to take it, and he took that little shot, swirled it around, and he held it up and said, "More," you know. So I bring my kids to meetings, you know, they know where to go, you know, they know. And finally, my oldest, Julianne, I'll never forget, she was 16, so this was 8 years ago. I was speaking in Palm Springs, or Indio, I guess it was, and the ABC Club, you remember the ABC Club? And Julianne, my 16-year-old daughter, was with me. She sat next to me like Jamie was tonight, and when the guy introduced me like Kevin did tonight, when whoever it was introduced me to come up and talk, my 16-year-old daughter, who was hanging out with her dad in the first place, reached over and kissed me on the cheek and said, "Good luck, Dad," you know, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't cry. Sometimes it gets me still, you know. I mean, it's amazing to me what this program is. You know, my role models, my idea of a dad was Clint Eastwood and John Wayne. I didn't mention my dad bailed when I was young. I never knew him. I forgot to mention that part of it. That's a whole other inventory, let me tell you. But I met him. My wife found him. I would have never looked him up because to him, I was a $90 a month check until I was 20 years old. He didn't know I turned 18. My mom wasn't going to tell him, "Hey, stop sending checks." And then my wife, you know, my beautiful wife, as I mentioned, of 24 and a half years, Jacqueline, we met on the train. I was in the military going from San Diego to Monterey to go to language school, and she had just graduated from high school and was going on a trip, and we fell in love, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, she's a wonderful member of Al-Anon and enjoys that program, and that program has kept our marriage together between her program and my program and this program, our program, you know, because we've been through a lot, you know, absolutely, no doubt about it. See, and Jacqueline, my wife, is a vertical thinker, you know. She likes more information, you know. I'm a horizontal thinker. I like yes or no answers, you know. And Jacqueline likes more information, you know. I put away the remote. I put it away where I know where it's going to be the next time I need it, you know. Jacqueline enjoys the hunt, you know. I like to watch TV. Jacqueline likes to watch TV, you know. You know, one channel at a time. Are you kidding me? You know, that's why we got previous channels. We can flick it back and forth, you know. I got a headache. I'm going to take 3 aspirin, maybe 4. I want that headache gone now, right? You know how many my wife takes? None. She wants to talk about the pain. You know, yeah. And I used to make a lot more fun. I used to tell jokes about Al-Anon, blah, blah. I don't do that anymore. Well, I just don't do it anymore. But one thing that did happen is, you know, we were leaving a convention somewhere one time, and she was mad, my wife, because I had told a bunch of Al-Anon jokes, and she said, you know, I said to her, if it wasn't for us, you wouldn't even have a program. Because, you know, Al-Anon, they took our program, right? They took all our program, all our steps, everything, and they can drink still. You know, it might be just what some of you are looking for. I don't know. But I said, if it wasn't for us, you wouldn't even have a program. She looked back at me and said, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't need a program. You know, so I, okay, touche. But for 24 and a half years, we've been together, been through a lot, and it's been a good deal. I appreciate what you've taught me, what Bob's taught me, and all the deals in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, we travel a lot, you know, with AA, the fellowship, whether it's just to be a member of, a part of, or whether it's to speak, or whatever it might be, you know, we get to spend time together and do the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. Polly P, Susie's sponsor. Polly was one of the speakers I brought into the penitentiary, and we absolutely fell in love with her, and Dave as well, and got to be good friends for a while when they lived down in the LA area, Alcoholics Anonymous taught me a lot. One of the things, and I'll share for the newcomers, I'll tell you this. It took me forever to understand this, and then I don't know how it came to me, but it did. See, there's nothing shameful about being an alcoholic, all right? There's nothing shameful about being an alcoholic. You know, we do shameful things when we're drunk. Absolutely, no doubt about it. You know, so do non-alcoholics. You know, once, you know, they do that shameful thing one time. And we think that, or at least me, you know, hey, it's going to be different this time, baby, I promise. You know, and pop the fifth of whiskey and drink it again. You know, people that are allergic to strawberries, they don't eat strawberries. Are they embarrassed because they can't eat strawberries? No, they just don't eat strawberries. You know, people that are allergic to penicillin, they wear a little deal around their bracelet that says, don't give me any penicillin. Are they embarrassed? No. There's nothing shameful about being I'm allergic to alcohol. When I drink alcohol, I want more. You know, so I don't drink it. You know, I come here and I work the steps and I do the deal. Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot like a swimming pool. And the way these chairs are set up tonight, you know, think of an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And the thing about it is that in the swimming pool of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are people that swim really, really well. They look good. You know, they swim well. They get to the edge of the pool. They do a kick turn with hardly a splash. They swim back the other way. They do it, and they look good. You know, and the thing for the newcomers is we want to be like that right now. You know, I want to swim that good right now. I know, I wanted to be the main speaker at the second speaker meeting I ever went to. You know, but they don't go, hey, you, new guy, angry one, you want to talk? You know, that's not what they do. You know what? You know how you get behind a podium? Is you put away chairs when this meeting's over. You sweep the floor. You know, which reminds me, I was going to start with it, but I thought, nah, I wouldn't get off on a bad foot. But see, I smoke. I started smoking again. I smoke on and off. And Kevin stood up here and he said twice, I think, he described where the smoking area is, you know? And what part of over at the canopy do we have trouble understanding? I must have seen 15 people light up as soon as we got outside the door. And you know what happens then? You see, first of all, you need a commitment for someone to pick up the cigarette butts that those people threw down there. And then when we don't get that commitment for those people to pick up those cigarette butts that those people who weren't listening to threw down there, you get kicked out of the church. That's what happens. I know. And I don't know how you guys lost your other church, but that's how we lost a church at that speaker meeting that I was telling you about. You know, so it's like, what part of smoke over there? Don't you? I'm a smoker. I'm not picking on you. I just noticed it. Trip me out. And then, so then, swimming pool of Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, there's all these people swimming, and there's people that are swimming really good. There's people doing the side stroke. There's people doing the backstroke. There's people treading water. There's people doing the breaststroke. Well, that's called the 13th step. But but if you stay in the pool of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll learn to swim. You know, and we'll give you everything we got for you to learn to swim, for fun and for free. Everything we got. That guy with 6 months sobriety that told me that I wasn't lucky, that I had a God looking out for me, he kept me afloat that day. But the thing is, you got to stay in the pool. You know, you cannot learn to swim reading about it in a book. You cannot learn to swim on a virtual program on the internet. You can't buy a movie on learning to swim. And learn to swim. You got to stay in the pool of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll give it to you for fun and for free. You know, chapter 6 is called Into Action, not called Into Thinking About, Into Planning to Do Tomorrow. You know, Into Action. And if you stay in the pool, we will give you, as I said, everything for fun and for free. So my wish to all of you in here tonight is that you stay in the pool, you know, and we will all live, all trudge the road or swim the road to happy destiny, happy, joyous, and free. Thanks.